Welcome to Season 10 of the HPS Cast. I'm your host, Colbert Cannon. If you're new to the pod, HPS is a global investment firm. We manage over $100 billion in assets for a broad range of institutional and individual investors. That capital is invested across private credit and public credit strategies. Each week, I sit down with key relationships to, partners of, and friends of the firm to learn from their experience, ask how that experience shapes their current roles, and give insights into HPS and how we operate. So with that, let's bring in our guest. Our guest this week is a leader of HPS's real estate finance practice. This gentleman graduated from Washington and Lee in the late 90s and started his career in finance trading structured products at Morgan Stanley and later Deutsche Bank. In 2004, he moved over to Goldman Sachs, where he would spend the bulk of his career, first in structured products and mortgage trading, and eventually becoming their global head of real estate finance. Like many prominent Goldman alums, when he stepped down in 2019, he moved into the public service sector, becoming Connecticut Governor Ned Lamont's senior economic advisor and commissioner. He served the Constitution State for 4 years in that role before we successfully convinced him to join HPS about a year ago. This gent is a great investor and a great business builder, but he's also a great person who I'm honored to call a partner. So, without any further ado, I'm thrilled to welcome in this week's HPS Cast guest, David Lehman of HPS's real estate business. David, welcome to the pod.
Thanks, Colbert. It's great to be here and an honor. That was quite a bio. I'm flattered.
This is your life moment. All right, David, let's go all the way back. Where'd you grow up? Where are you from originally?
I grew up in central New Jersey, a small town called Montgomery, just north of Princeton. My mom was a teacher and my father was a professor at Rutgers University.
Well-educated folks. All right. So you end up going to undergraduate at WNL. Why was that the right choice for you, David?
I wanted to play tennis in college and I was able to play at Washington and Lee. It was a Division III tennis program. And I really fell in love with the campus, fell in love with the people there, went there in the mid-90s and never looked back. And it still holds a very special place in my heart.
David, what did you study undergrad?
Business administration. Initially, I thought I would do chemistry and perhaps medicine or science, but ultimately shifted to business. And here I am.
So you end up going down the finance path. Tell me about that first job out of college. You started on Morgan Stanley's structured products trading desk. Tell us about that first opportunity. What were you doing?
Yeah. So one of the neat things about Washington Lee, very small school, but a very engaged alumni network. So, you know, I kind of lucked into that job in many ways. I was able to intern at the New York Stock Exchange in the late 90s. And this was during a bull market in stocks before the tech bubble, but the run up to the tech bubble. And I met a lot of people when I worked at the Stock Exchange, including a number of folks from Morgan Stanley. And they asked me to apply for their program as an analyst. And of course, I wanted to do equities, given that was all the rage in the late 90s. But they said, no, we may have a spot in fixed income for you. Why don't you consider that? So I did. And I met a bunch of people. The mortgage department had openings. Structured products group had openings. And that was kind of a natural place for me. I liked math. I ultimately really enjoyed fixed income and getting to understand the bond market and how it worked. And basically was the analyst supporting many parts of the structured products trading desk. So that was everything from spreadsheets to getting a lot of Starbucks back then.
Let's define some basics for those less familiar. What is a structured product, David?
So structured product was pools of assets, whether it was mortgages, credit card receivables, it could be residential, commercial, other types of loans that were pooled into what were then securitizations and still are securitizations. So tranches of those asset pools were then sold to investors with different risk profiles, different credit ratings. From a structure perspective, they could also take different time to repayment when there is variability around repayment, in particular for residential mortgages, when you could be paid back very quickly or in a very long time, depending on the rate environment.
So simply, if there's an individual mortgage, you could buy or sell it, or you could take, you know, hundreds or thousands of mortgages, pool them together in one big pool, and then tranche it up and sell off and trade various pieces of it. Yes?
That's right. That's right. It was a way to access a market as opposed to just be reliant on an individual investor. If you wanted to take out a loan, you could access big pools of investors that had different risk tolerance.
All right. So you're getting coffee, you're running spreadsheets. I always think first jobs are on some level formative. Tell me about the lessons that you learned in those early days working at Morgan Stanley.
There's always two main lessons I think that come to my mind sitting here, you know, 25 years approximately later. You know, one is a very, very strong analyst and kind of when I found I was being most helpful or useful, whether it's the clients or people that I was working for, is the ability to anticipate. You know, what is the next question? What is the next issue? What's the problem that's coming up? And how can I be one or two steps ahead in terms of starting to solve that problem and be useful? So I learned very, very quickly that those who could anticipate and were proactive in that regard, they were the ones that were being very successful. and just making sure that you're useful, you're accessible and available, but always thinking forward is really, really important. And the second thing I learned really quickly on a trading desk is situational awareness, you know, the ability to understand very quickly what's happening, the emotions on the floor, in person, on the phone, and how important empathy is in terms of the business and the leaders of the business and how they manage the team. You really learn very, very quickly in that trading floor environment. And, you know, I love it to this day. I miss it from time to time still as the world has moved on.
It's funny, David, I always say that people sort of forget the human aspect of our job. Like, on one level, trading is numbers and analytics. On another level, there's an emotional intelligence matters greatly, and being able to read the room. I always think that matters more than people give credit for. Okay, so you're trading, you spend some time at Morgan Stanley, you spent a year in a similar role at Deutsche Bank before you eventually joined Goldman as their head of CMBS trading. Why make the move over to Goldman then? What was the appeal of that transition?
Yeah, for me, and really both the moves from Morgan Stanley to Deutsche Bank and then from Deutsche to Goldman, it was about more responsibility and growth opportunities, like how many people make moves or decide to make moves. And Goldman was unique at the time in structured products. They didn't actually have the presence that Morgan Stanley had or that Deutsche Bank had. They had an incredible investment banking franchise. They were aspirational in many parts of the mortgage and structured products business, but I viewed it as a real growth opportunity to take on more responsibility as it relates to the commercial mortgage trading business, but ultimately to potentially expand beyond that, to learn new products, to work in different areas, not just the US, for example. I spent some time in Europe as well. So that was really important to me at that point in my career when I thought about growth and where the next 5 to 10 years were.
Okay, so January 2008, you become the co-head of mortgage trading at Goldman Sachs, which is really incredible timing. I mean, you take that job staring right down the barrel of the global financial crisis. You had a front row seat to history. Let's start with the big picture. How did you manage your business through the most volatile markets in the history of CMBS and really global finance broadly?
It was truly a unique time, you know, and it was a business that I'd been involved in for the mortgage business broadly 9 or 10 years almost at this point in time. And I continued to learn more about the business, clients, the products, and really managing the risk of that business, both on the commercial real estate side of things and then beyond to more broadly structured products. You know, when I think about those times today, you know, they were incredibly long, stressful hours, whether it's at Goldman, really all around trading desks, our clients, and you saw just precipitous declines in asset prices and bond prices, which further exacerbated that stress. And one of my big takeaways from the financial crisis in particular is when you have that magnitude of losses at levered institutions, you know, the cascading effect or the cycle that leads is quite violent in terms of the magnitude of those losses, and losses beget more losses. And it was really a rough 12 or 18 month period there, but ultimately we managed through it. And really one of the other really important things from my vantage point was making sure that the team was motivated, because you're working 7 days a week, long hours each day, making sure that the team understood where True North was and how we were trying to navigate through it and work with our clients to navigate through it.
You raised an interesting point there. Well, first, on your lessons learned, you know, I always think about you learn more when things go wrong than when things go right. And the lessons learned of the secondary and tertiary impacts of market disruption, I think any of us who lived through the global financial crisis carry with us. But, you know, in a career path like yours, you did make a transition over time from directly investing and analyzing to managing businesses and people. And you touched on that. How do you manage people differently in a moment of stress like that? Like, it's one thing to be aware of it. Of course, that matters. What actually do you do when things are like that, that, you know, helps make sure, as you say, that you keep people focused on True North?
Yeah, for me, it was listening more and talking less, which isn't always easy. But I think going back to my point, when I was an analyst 1 or 2 years out of college, the situational awareness, understanding what's happening in the market, what's happening with the team, what's happening with our clients, really in times of stress, you need to do an even better job of that and make sure that you're spending time, whether it's walking the trading floor, on the phone with clients, understanding the issues that are out there with all the stakeholders, really, really important. And then when communicating to the team, in particular in times of stress, doing it as concisely as possible, but with as much empathy, because everyone is under considerable stress. You certainly don't want to be adding to it. So being long-winded, that is less effective in most times, and it's very ineffective in times of market stress.
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. All right, so the crisis is weathered, the world and Goldman recover. You eventually move over to run real estate finance on the banking side. Tell me about how that move came about.
Great question. The thought was at the time, Goldman had become a bank during the financial crisis. So there were opportunities to grow the bank's balance sheet in various businesses, and mortgages and real estate lending was certainly one of those businesses. Secondly, the primary market business, originating loans from Goldman clients to either pool together or single loans or single loan portfolios to securitize both in the US and in Europe. We thought that was a really interesting time to do that business, to lean into that business and try to grow market share.
Tell me about that transition. You spoke wistfully about the hectic days on a trading desk. It is different on the banking side. How was that transition for you?
It wasn't too different in that I was on the fifth floor, I think, of Goldman's headquarters at the time, and I moved up to the seventh floor. And actually, the financing group at Goldman was still in a trading floor layout. So a little bit different in terms of the pace was different in some ways. The hours were different.
Maybe marginally less yelling.
No, yes, right. There was less cursing for sure in the more staid world of investment banking. I needed to adapt myself, I think, in many ways to that. One of the great things about Goldman is you had a very consistent culture and really strong communication. So it was, I'm sure there were some bumps in the road, but it was fairly seamless.
Well, and it's interesting, David, I think firm culture is a hard thing to put your finger on. I joined Goldman to start my career in 97, and I remember they really drilled into us early that ethic of over-communication. You know, what I think of Goldman in the old private days, one of the things that made it really unique culturally was that team-driven environment. And you can't do that if you're not aggressive about making sure that everybody's looped in, that there's great communication, all of that. And it's one of their real calling cards that I think they've continued. If I can compliment us for a second, I do think that one of the things that HPS culturally has gotten right is that old school Goldman ethic of communication that fosters that right sort of team-driven environment. Okay, so you have a great run over your career at Goldman. In February of 2019, you stepped down. Why was it the right time then to leave the mothership?
I wasn't sure it was the right time, I guess. And maybe the best way to describe it is it was the end of 18 and the political division where everyone was either on the left or the right, and there wasn't a pragmatism in government. At least this was my perception, Colbert, at the time. Bothered me. And we, I live in Connecticut. My wife's from Connecticut. We've lived up there since 2009. We had a new governor, Ned Lamont, elected. I didn't know him at all, but he struck me as a pragmatic technocrat. He's a former businessman, not a lifelong politician. And he had a very matter-of-fact, genuine style and middle-of-the-road centrist mindset from what I could tell. So I cold called him effectively and said, if I can be useful to you, here's my resume. I've been at Goldman for 15 years, and I think this is my skill set. And sure enough, after two or three meetings, a couple weeks later, we jointly established this role where I served as economic advisor on things related to policy for the governor in his first term. And then I ran economic development in Connecticut, which is roughly 110 people focused on everything from marketing, culture, museums, business retention, recruitment, and other parts of the portfolio. So we were really the eyes and the ears of the administration to the business community and vice versa.
I'm always interested in how people manage transitions like this. Like, you're going from for-profit to the government sector. It's a very different environment. How did you learn what you didn't know? You're an incredibly bright guy, but I'm sure there's a million things that you were asked to do that were outside of your core skill set. How did you successfully make that all work?
In a similar way to when I was leaving college in the late 90s and starting at Morgan Stanley, you spend a lot of time with the stakeholders, the decision makers. So in government, when I moved there, it was understanding the senators, the representatives, the governor's core team, the various different state agencies, my peers in Department of Transportation, Environmental Protection, and getting to know them and establishing that rapport and understanding where there's an overlap in the Venn diagram in terms of what needs to be done and what can be done in the administration.
So you did a lot during those 4 years. And as a Connecticut resident, what are you proudest of accomplishing for your home state?
Listen, I think it's a couple things I would say. You know, one, fiscal responsibility was something the governor was really, really strong and vocal on. So there were, I think, close to $9 billion of surplus over a 5 or 6 year period now. 2/3 of that roughly went to pay down pension debt. And that was a problem that was created in Connecticut over 70 or 75 years. And Governor Lamont really wanted to address that. And the state has a best in class rainy day fund. So the fiscal guardrails and fiscal conservatism that was really underscored by the governor. And then lastly, I'll say I got to do things from an economic development perspective. A number of companies came into the state, lots of jobs created in the state, certainly post the COVID era, rather. But the other thing that we did is when the state allowed sports betting back in 2021 and online casino gaming, you know, I was part of the team that worked with Native American tribes in Connecticut on how will that work? How will that get operationalized? So lots of stuff like that I would not have been able to do at Goldman Sachs. And I recommend for those listeners out there, anyone that has the bug to do public service, I highly recommend it. Most fulfilling job I've ever had and one of the hardest jobs I've ever had.
Well, and I imagine you must have learned so much too. I mean, you're asked to do so many different things across so many different multidisciplinary, you know, and as you say, with multiple different stakeholders, like there's just a lot of learnings and all that, I'm sure. Super interesting. Okay, so David, you did that for 4 years, and I want to talk about the decision to come here. So when our CEO, Scott Kapnick, you know, makes the call, what were those first discussions like? Tell me, what was the fireside pitch?
I knew I wanted to do something back in the private sector, and I thought it was a great time to re-enter real estate on the credit side, given where we are in the market, given the movement in interest rates, some of the disruption in the market with existing lenders, banks in particular. I think there's a lot of opportunities. So I spent time, you know, with Scott, and that led to a number of conversations. But the way that I think about it is HPS has developed a track record and reputation in private credit and direct lending. You guys have done that well for over 15 years now. When I think about adjacent legs of the stool as HPS continues to expand its business, real estate is absolutely one where I think we can and should build a much bigger business here. So that was a lot of the conversation, and I'm really glad to be here.
You mentioned this in terms of the timing and the rates move. You know, real estate is a cyclical business, which people forget because we spent the better part of two decades with the most accommodative central bank policies in history. When you look at that landscape now, what gets you most excited about real estate finance?
The 15 years of the zero interest rate environment that you referenced before, that caused a lot of investing, a lot of growth in portfolios. For example, banks doubled their portfolios in real estate lending from 2012 to last year. And you just saw decision-making as a result of that environment that I think is being unwound right now. And I think that is the opportunity. When you had real interest rates go from close to negative 100 basis points at the end of 21 to close to positive 200 basis points now, that type of move coupled with the growth in portfolios and where assets have been aggregated, I think you're going to see new lending, new owners of those assets for the next cycle, whether that be 15 or 20 years.
So on that, David, we've seen several banks fail. You've seen pressures in commercial and regional banks given their portfolios. Let me put your macro prognosticator hat on. Like, listen, complexity creates opportunities, but like, how does this all play out? That unwind, as you started hinting at, give me some perspectives as to where you see opportunities in real estate and where that complexity is going to really arise.
Yeah, so maybe just to put some numbers on it first. So you have pricing in commercial real estate broadly across the market down roughly 20% in terms of asset prices since the beginning of 2022. Public markets imply roughly an incremental 10% decline. So if you're 30% peak to trough, that's a pretty big move. You're not at financial crisis levels and you're not at the S&L crisis of the early 90s levels. But given some of the risk around office and some of the obsolescence risk on some of the real estate that's out there, you're going to see, in my opinion, real estate change hands, whether that's through foreclosures, just sales from existing owners to new owners, or other means of assets getting recapitalized. You have this reckoning in the market given the price decline. And unlike right after the financial crisis, where you had very, very low interest rates and arguably that minimized the pain for many, you don't have that right now. And in my opinion, it's not clear that's coming. So as a result of that, you're going to have a longer period, a more protracted period, where you're going to see this decline in these changes of assets that's going to create new financing opportunities and new asset acquisition opportunities across asset classes. And then last thing, I've been in the real estate market now for 25 years. There were times when hotels were out of favor, when retail and malls were out of favor. And now, you know, office was long viewed as kind of a core rock solid asset class. And you're seeing the disruption there with work from home, the power that tenants have relative to the power that landlords have in the current market. And that obsolescence risk coupled with the change in discount rates and borrowing rates in real estate is really causing this opportunity. And again, I think it's going to be a longer time period than what you had coming out of the financial crisis, given where the interest rate market is.
Yeah, it's such an interesting point, David, because it's really the double impact. It's not just the rates move, right? An 80% levered asset that has a 30% decline in value, obviously, is suddenly your equity's underwater. But then what if the actual value, even beyond the rates move, is impacted, as you said, by obsolescence, work from home, all these changes? It's sorting through all of that is quite complicated. The timing is also interesting to me. When this all started happening, as listeners, longtime listeners will remember, I occasionally recommend books from previous economic crises. And I started reading books about the savings and loan crisis because, you know, I was alive when that happened, but but I wasn't in an investing seat. And one of the things that I was really struck by was how long it took to play out. You know, unlike 08, 09, which was a profoundly disruptive period, by 2010, you know, from a capital markets and economic perspective, you were basically back to where you were pre-crisis. Real estate takes a long time to play out, you know, certainly from the savings and loan experience. Is that the same here? Like, is this a 1 to 2 year event or is this a 5 to 10 year event in your mind?
I think it's probably somewhere in between, you know, three to four years if I, and again, there's some, this is a guess, an educated guess, but a guess nonetheless.
We've got your crystal ball out, David.
We're not going to hold you. Yeah. I think if you look empirically, you see activity trough, you know, roughly 3 to 4 years after crises. Maybe it's 2 to 3 years after crises. And that's typically right around then is when you see the maximum decline in terms of asset prices. And why I think you could see the investing opportunity be longer than that, you know, plus or minus 3 years, is given where we are in terms of interest rates. And I just don't think it's going to be possible or probable that you're going to see a ZIRP environment coming back anytime soon, which I think is going to be an added headwind to those asset prices. So I think you could see asset prices bounce around for a little while longer than they typically do.
I think that's right, David. Super interesting. Well, listen, David, we're incredibly excited about what you're up to. Always a pleasure to catch up. Thank you for all those thoughtful insights. With that, I want to move to the last segment of the pod, something we'd like to call Best Ideas. This is where we offer up something that's added value in our lives recently, Best Ideas, because it's our goal as investors to maximize exposure to those. David, you're our guest. I'm going to ask you to go first. What is your best idea this week?
You referenced kind of books, and we talked a bunch about the financial crisis here. And, you know, one book, especially for those that weren't in the business then, Andrew Ross Sorkin wrote a book called Too Big to Fail. So that's the one. If for those that haven't read and just want to read one book, I would absolutely read that. You know, for my other best idea, let me take it away from work in the financial crisis. So my wife and I have two teenagers at home right now, and trying to find an activity that keeps all of us engaged for a period of time is increasingly hard as our kids have gotten older. And two things I would just mention. One is a television show, Modern Family, which for those that don't know it, we love it. There's, I think, 8 or 9 seasons, I want to say, but something for everyone in there. And the jokes are funny, regardless of age. So heartily recommend that. And then another thing on the same lines, we did a vacation last summer with a company called Backroads. Active vacation. It was a cycling multi-sport type vacation in Europe, but they're very, very great for folks with kids that may want to do different things and keep the whole family engaged. So those are two things that I recommend. And you can bring Andrew Ross Sorkin's book along with you.
Those are great recommendations. If you're too lazy to read the book, the movie Too Big to Fail is also quite good, though I think anybody who's really interested in what happened, the granularity and depth in the book is hard to beat. So a great series of recommendations there. So then for you, David, and for my best idea, as people know, I like to be inspired by the guest of the week. David, as we talked about, attended Washington and Lee. And as you may know, the Washington in that name is, of course, the U.S. founding father, George Washington, who in 1796 gave $20,000 as an endowment to save a then struggling Liberty Hall Academy, thus giving his name to what would become Washington Lee. I started thinking about Washington. And so my best idea this week, I think, is the best telling of the story of George Washington, the incredible Ron Chernow biography, Washington, A Life. But today, I want to recommend Chernow's 2010 masterpiece about the life of the first U.S. president. Fair warning, it is a massive tome. It's like 900 pages long. But like all of Chernow's books, it's incredibly researched and deeply educational, but it also reads like a novel and will keep you engaged throughout. So in honor of a WNL grad, my best idea this week is Ron Chernow's Washington, A Life, a truly stunning and important book. All right, David, with that, it's time to wrap up for the week. We sincerely appreciate you taking the time today, excited for what is to come for HPS's real estate business. And thank you so much for being here.
Colbert, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks again to our guest, David Lehman. Check out our show notes to learn more about David and his work at HPS. There, you'll also find a link to his two best ideas, the family favorite TV sitcom, Modern Family, and the family-friendly active tour company, Backroads. And you'll find more about my best idea, the biography Washington, A Life by Pulitzer Prize winner Ron Chernow. This podcast was brought to you by At Will Media with HPS Investment Partners. Please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. The opinions expressed on this podcast are that of the host, Colbert Cannon, and the guest of each episode, and do not necessarily reflect the views of HPS Investment Partners.